You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
You know what's amazing? Walking into your favorite bar or coffee shop and running into an author you absolutely love. Or bumping into an author you've never heard of before, but find your new favorite book. That's what we do on Drinking with Authors. You get to hear all the stories of what made the author's stories great and how they got there on their journey. So grab a drink and join us on Drinking with Authors.
Evidently, you do not realize you are in an interstellar conveyance. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack!
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And we're going to do something we've been doing a lot this season, and that is going back and revisiting some classic films and giving them another look. And this is a film that certainly deserves more than one look on Monster Attack. And we're going to really do it right, because not only do we have one co-host this week, but two. Madeline is back with us, and she has dragged along Shane with us as well. Shane Morton sitting in with us as well.
Hey.
First time he's a virgin on Monster Attack, so to get to break.
That feels good.
Well, actually, you have appeared on a couple of shows in the background. We'd hear you walking through and make comments.
The Peanut Gallery.
Right. So, great to have you guys both here talking about The Wolfman. And if you're listening to the show and on its initial release, let's say you guys have a spook show coming up. What is it, this weekend?
Next weekend.
Well, the time of release of the podcast, it will be it's Saturday coming up. So 4/1, and this movie came out in 1941.
Yeah.
How about that?
Oh, so that's how you came. I was wondering how you came up with the.
Actually,
with the,
well, we yeah, did it April for.
We did it for Lon Chaney, because I was like, we need to do a movie that celebrates Lon Chaney, because it's Lon Chaney Senior's birthday is April Fool's, but the next best celebration would be his son, and
absolutely
this is his standout.
And we've never shown The Wolfman at the spook show, so we're really
you never stoked. Have yeah. Wow, that and oh. I'm really surprised to hear that. I would have thought that would have been in there by now. Oh, this is a real treat.
You
guys have been doing the spook show for a long, long time, and I know you, and for those folks who live in the Atlanta area may not be familiar with the Silver Screen Spook Show. They do two shows on a Saturday. They do one, 1:30, I think. And then you do a nighttime one.
At 1:30.
And then a nighttime
that's
one.
Right.
So the 1:30 one generally has a lot of kids in it. That's when you get your younger crowd.
Oh, yeah, we were almost sold out when we did King Kong almost a month ago.
Yeah the show's back.
Oh, I hated missing
the COVID
that.
Thing is done.
Yeah,
so we had a line around the block to get into King Kong. A movie that's 90 years old and
absolutely
still is selling out a theater. That was really exciting. But yes, the afternoon show is family oriented, and it's a great day out for everybody. So, and then the nighttime show.
What do you think is going to be the appeal of The Wolfman to some of the younger crowd that, because there's a lot of werewolf movies out there now from the time
I grew up. The allure of the original.
There's no better werewolf movie than this one, though. This is the quintessential werewolf movie.
I have to agree.
From which all, the wellspring from which all werewolf movies flow.
Well, that's true. Because a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the legends that they equate with werewolves probably came from this movie, a good many of them.
Oh, yeah.
Kurt
Siodmak had to come up with all this.
Including the poem.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like the old Arabian proverb at the beginning of King Kong. It was some Hollywood script writers.
Right.
Or a flash of genius, not an ancient poem or whatever. But yeah, Kurt Siodmak came up with all this mythology and the rules of werewolfism and all this stuff. And they still kind of stick today, you know, even though people get it wrong here and there.
You know, even, you know, the little poem, "Even a man who says his prayers at night will become a wolf."
A man has a pure heart. Yeah.
I always thought that was a real old legend. I really thought that was legitimate. And I mean, I was well into my adult years before I found out about that one. It was like, oh my God, he made that up. I didn't have any idea about that. But I can remember.
And now it is a real old legend.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was going to say it's 80 something.
It's old enough to be a legend now.
80.
It's
80
and I think that's when, Madeline, I think that's when you and I did this show. We did it for the 80th anniversary, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's when we did the Wolfman. Was like,
oh, well, perfect.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. So, yeah, time to pull it back out and do it. And we'll do it again in a couple of years. But I remember in the 80s going to see The Howling, the very first Howling in the movie theaters, and people walking out going, I can't believe they just shot him with a regular gun. You know, and I heard that also at American Werewolf in London. They didn't use a silver bullet. You know, some people have totally believed that this is actually not made up at all or whatever. But this film, I agree with you, Shane. I think it, in my mind, is my favorite werewolf movie of all time and always will be.
Yeah, I think it's gonna stand the test of time too. Like, it's funny, there aren't a lot of films that pass the 100-year mark that people still go to and watch over and over again and study and whatnot. And all these Universal monster movies are going to live on forever, you know, not just because they're so good, but because I think that they were working really hard to put a mythic quality to them. Yeah, like the Wolfman is more of it's almost like a fairy tale. It's more of a fantasy film than a horror movie. Actually. Yeah.
Actually, I think that there's a line in the movie where they mentioned something about, I've heard it, or I think it was in this movie after watching so many movies today, where they mentioned Little Red Riding Hood and say, well, that's a werewolf story.
Oh yeah,
and, it's like when you think about it, it actually is.
That is in this movie.
I can remember this is not the first werewolf movie I ever saw. When I got introduced to Monster Movie Matinee, I saw one called The Werewolf, which was more of a science fiction than anything. It was a '50s film about these mad scientists that had tried to make a man who could survive a nuclear holocaust or whatever, and he ends up becoming a werewolf and getting lost in the mountains of northern California.
Yeah.
So that was my first exposure to werewolves, with the exception of the third monster movie I ever saw, which was Daughter of Dr. Jekyll, and they took the Dr. Jekyll story, made that a werewolf story.
Yeah.
So that, you know, so, but this was the first Aurora model I ever built.
Oh, wow.
I remember we used to have this thing, you know, on Sundays we would go to this drugstore. And it was just what everybody did in a little town. It's sort of like what people do at Walmart now, I guess. And I remember after being introduced to monsters, I saw monster models and I went, oh my God, what are these? This is great. You know, because before that, I didn't even know what they were. I didn't even pay any attention. So I bought the Wolfman. So I could not wait to see this movie after building that model. So I sort of knew what the makeup looked like it did not let me down. It did not let me down at all. Oh my God. I was so psyched when I saw this film.
Yeah. I got lucky when I was a little kid. I got to see it and I loved it so much. I had a Wolfman sweater that I used to wear. I even wore it in like my third grade school pictures. It glowed in the dark. It was incredible.
Was it made out of yak hair?
No, it was a little more comfortable than that. Pure polyester.
That's pretty expensive. If you get like a real nice.
No, we use yak hair.
I know you do.
We use it today to make our werewolves, like all the werewolf suits that we use for special effects and whatnot, all the fake hair.
Right.
It's still yak hair. You know, it's put together by National Fiber, this company that makes this great stuff. But yak hair is always a part of this stuff.
Yeah,
because it's the best hair there is for monsters.
Well, I think because for this they had it, they curled it with a curling iron or something. I guess
they singed it.
Singed it
so it must stand up better than some of the other hair that you could use.
Well, it's very coarse.
Yeah,
and wiry almost.
And very uncomfortable.
Very uncomfortable. So could, if you could imagine as uncomfortable as it would be to have all that thick, wiry hair glued to your face.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Then he comes through and burns the hair, burnt hair. So he must have, the smell must have been just terrible, too. Like, yeah. He suffered for this role, for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Was, I think he was so proud of it. That was,
oh, yeah.
He played every single. Yeah, it was his baby, as he called it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He played every single Wolfman.
When people think of Lon Chaney Jr., they definitely think of the Wolfman.
No, this is his signature role. I mean, some people may say Of Mice and Men. Yeah, that's a real close second, but I think this is the one. People think of him in this role, not more so than Lenny. But, and it's amazing. I don't even know if we talked about this the last time. He was not the first choice to play this role.
Wasn't it for Boris Karloff?
Well, Boris Karloff is who they wrote. Yeah, when they wrote the screenplay, they wrote it for Boris Karloff, and he didn't want to do it. Then they were thinking of Dick Foran, who had been in all their Mummy movies, but he didn't want to do it either. Bela Lugosi wanted to do it and was championing to do it, and you know, just bugging the studio about doing it, but they gave him the role of Boris.
Yeah, of course.
First werewolf, so he got to play a werewolf in Wolfman, but not the one he wanted. And then they go to Lon Chaney Jr., and, it's like, I can't even imagine anyone else playing this role. I was trying to plug in the others they were talking about. It's like, no, that's Chaney brought the tortured aspects of this into the story so well. It's still, even today, watching it this morning, I cannot believe how strong his performance was in this thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible cast.
Well, not many people pulled off pathos better than, especially better than Chaney Sr. Nobody in the history of film acting can even come close.
Right.
But his son had this added bit of,
longing
for respect from his father. Mm-hmm. Like, it all comes bubbling out in this performance, and it's absolutely incredible to watch because you feel the torture this guy's going through.
Yeah. Now, one thing I had read in one of my film books, and I didn't know for many years, was that the original story that was written for this movie was not going to have Lon Chaney Jr. and Claude Rains as father and son, that they originally wrote him as an American engineer who was coming to fix the telescope that the father had in his observatory. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, man, that would have made a pretty good story. I'm going to bring that out.
Well, he is. He is there.
I mean, because he is an American. I mean, he's an engineer. He's not, living in the United States, but.
Yeah,
but I kept thinking, you took that element out of it. Then people don't have to say, geez, father's awful short to have a kid that big. That's something that I always.
I'd love to have seen the wife.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. I always think that when I watch the movie. Mother must be like 7 feet tall.
Yeah.
We'll never know. We just get to imagine.
Yeah, you never get that information.
Yeah.
And then to see Ralph Bellamy in this, that always I get a kick out of that one, because I'm so used to seeing him on American television or in American movies. But it's a nice trade off with him and Lon Chaney Jr. in this. And then you throw in Patrick Knowles for the little triangle effect. Patrick has always been a favorite of mine. I mean, we see him again. He and Lon Chaney team up. And a little bit different. He's a doctor in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman.
Yeah. So. I love Patrick Knowles. Yeah, ever since, Adventures of Robin Hood.
Oh, God, yes, yeah.
You know. But then I became a fan of him personally after reading a lot of these Hollywood sort of dirt stories on him and Errol Flynn and the trouble they used to get into together, because Patrick Knowles was like a serious partier back then. So to hear these stories about those guys, or Patrick Knowles was really him and Errol Flynn were really wolfmen.
Whoa. Real, I'm surprised they didn't ask Errol Flynn to play the wolfman. Mm-hmm. That's true. Well, I can
he
see now
been a little too much of a mess.
Yeah.
I can see now why Lon Chaney and Patrick Knowles got along so well, it seemingly on the set, because Lon Chaney was a pretty good partier in his own right.
Yeah,
as well. So
he would go out and have drinking contests and all that stuff.
Well, he got into some trouble before this production because he got drunk and vandalized some of the set or something and made a mess out of it. So Evelyn Anchors ended up getting his dressing room, and he never forgave her for that. So he was constantly playing little gags on her and scaring her with the makeup. And
I don't think they were particularly fond
of wasn't
No, really they, she was not fond of Lon Chaney Jr. at all.
But boy, you can tell, sort of, but they are still very good.
It plays into the story. I mean, it plays it into does, the story really well.
She's got this torn situation of being already engaged. And
right.
Then, but there's attraction and the allure, and he's there. And
love the bad boys.
Yeah, he's persistent.
And I love you. I know Patrick Knowles is caught in the middle.
He is persistent.
Patrick actually technically works for him, so now he's got that to deal with. You know, this guy basically who's his boss coming on to his fiance. he's not in a very
It's a complicated love triangle,
right? It sure is. What are some of your favorite parts of the movie? But we'll go with Shane because he didn't get to sit in with us the last time. Just any particular scenes that that you've always really loved?
My favorite stuff in the movie that doesn't involve Chaney Jr. just tearing it up is all the stuff with Maria Svinskaya. She's all cool stuff with the gypsy.
Yeah,
it lays this, and that's what I said. One of the reasons why I think this movie is really going to stand the test of time and live on is because it's like a fairy tale, and all the stuff with Uspenskaya really plays like a fantasy film, and it's real. Even the scenes are shot real fantastical. They've really glossed up the lens, and they crank up like all the forest is so beautifully done. How like everything is so enshrouded in this magical fog. The trees have been painted with black lacquer, and they've got hot lights blasting on them, and it just looks so unreal and fantastic.
It does.
So that's always been the thing that stands out for me is the fantasy quality of it, the fairy tale quality of the movie.
Oh, the atmosphere in this film, is unbelievable. Absolutely. You're right.
And I love all the witchcraft stuff.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah. It has a lot, and all the, Bela Lugosi, he's great in it. He doesn't have a whole lot to do, but what he does is great. He sets the whole thing.
Absolutely.
Kind of sets the weird tone of this thing. I'm pretty sure that I'd have to go back and look, but it gets weird when he's in the scenes. They've almost like, there's almost a Dutch to the camera and everything. It gets weird when you're in the wagon. But that stuff is, the way they do the star, the pentagram appearing, all that stuff. And there's like a real deep,
very symbolic.
Yeah, it's real symbolic stuff happening there too, because of escaped Nazi Germany, and he knew what it was like
to be
branded with a mark.
Yeah.
And it's so there's all this deep meaning for these things that are happening on the screen, and it really gives like I keep saying this, but it gives it a mythic power, that
film.
Yeah,
that's
really
a great way to put it. Yeah, absolutely.
And partially because of these sort of iconographic things that keep, really dominating the screen and dominating the story. It really does the trick.
Yeah, it's a lot of this movie takes place on a huge soundstage, and normally that would bug me a little bit. And even though you're aware that it is a set, I mean, for if you've been watching movies a long time, I'm in love with this set. I mean, the set design on this film, as you were saying, is just so incredible. Of course, there's some familiar scenes in there from Frankenstein. I mean, the little village. Yeah, they used the back lot. And then one, which I don't know if this was done intentionally or not, but they've got for many years as a kid, it was sort of a throwaway scene where they're going to church. And then all of a sudden, after I've been watching a lot of classic films, kept thinking, man, that looks familiar. And it was from The Hunchback of Notre Dame, from the version that his father was in. And it was the doorway to the cathedral, to the entrance to the cathedral from the 20s.
That,
Hunchback. It was back there on the lot. So I don't know if that's something George Wagner did on purpose, just to say, let's pay a little homage to Lon's dad here a little bit or whatever. Because you could easily see Lon Chaney Sr. doing this role as well. But yeah, I thought that was so cool. It was like, yeah, all these little familiar sites that the Universal reused on their back lot. It sort of made you feel like you were at home. Every time I see this, you know, sort of, I look for other things. What else did they use maybe that I didn't catch before? I think the only thing that ever got to me as I got older watching this movie was the clothes change on Lon Chaney and the Wolfman. I mean, I knew what he was going to be wearing from the monster model.
Yeah.
And then it was like, wait a minute, didn't he have a suit on when this thing started, or didn't he have a t-shirt on when this, you know?
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I didn't care after a while. I was just like,
that's right.
Yeah.
It didn't matter.
Who cares? You know, you really have to suspend disbelief when you're watching movies about werewolves.
People turning, you know, animals.
That's something that they get, you know, we get conditioned for that sort of suspension of disbelief by reading comic books. And, you know, for some reason, every time the Hulk hulks out, his clothes turn purple and white, and it's just the way it is, you know. And they'll go back to normal when he's back to normal.
It has something to do with the green skin. That's always been my thing.
Yeah.
It's an optical illusion. Madeline, have you got a specific scene or group of scenes that it's hard to find one that's better than the others, but they're all so good.
I think maybe I mentioned this last time, the transformation is very engaging. And I think that's probably what brings you back to the rewatch value is the, and it's kind of pieces of the transformation. So it makes you super curious about what he's going to end up looking like. Cause it's not really, they don't really show it all at once.
No.
You get to imagine and there he is. So it's this great, and it goes right along with the music building, and we keep building this story, and what is he going to be? And I don't know, that suspense is great. And I think that adds to the fairy tale quality that both of you have been talking about. There really is not much better storytelling than these not just fables, but this sort of world building of archetypes that we all recognize culturally, and I can't speak right now, but that bring us all back to this basal sort of instinct of being curious about the way a human and an animal could be in one. And that's been just about every single fairy tale. And it's something that we've all wondered about.
We've got a werecat that's trying to get on the action.
Yeah, we have a werecat that's trying to get on the story here.
I saw the whiskers coming in and out. I was like, Kitty, come on, join the conversation. I have to wonder on the transformation scenes, because I've always been really intrigued with how they shot that, because it was done more with editing than it was with the crossfading effect that they used in
with the lap dissolves.
Yeah. In the first, now I'm blanking on this, Werewolf of London. I would just wonder if that influenced how they decided to do the transformation, you know, try something a little different.
Yeah.
Kitty's getting into this.
I think that the transformations in Werewolf of London are really awesome too, though.
Oh, no, they were great. Yeah.
You know, they were really sneaky with like walking past the pillars and doing
that. That's always my favorite. Intense. Yep.
Yeah. And that's a trickier shot than it looks like, because that's all done with rear projection and editing tricks. And it's a lot trickier than it looks. And
yeah, because you got the cameras tracking at the same time. And it makes it really difficult.
Yeah. The timing on the rear projection footage must have been crazy to get look as seamless as it did.
Yeah.
But the thing that gets me the most about the second transformation that happens in the hospital is not the great lap dissolve stuff and the way they pull off the makeup. It's that plaster pillow that he's on. because people don't think about this stuff, mm-hmm. right? But everything is has to be so locked down.
Yes.
So yeah. he was not laying in bed comfortably while they applied that makeup. He was probably was locked into a plaster pillow that yeah. they had sculpted out of plaster. So nothing would move as all these technicians were moving around and doing all this stuff. It's just people don't think about these little minutiae that it takes to pull off these really elaborate special effects, you know, just like
yeah.
how, for instance, in King Kong, all the foliage on Skull Island is made of steel. Like, that just blew my mind when I was wow. a little kid, and I was like, oh, they had to cut every leaf out of tin because nothing could move.
Right, you yeah. know? Yeah, otherwise it would be background obvious what they were doing.
Yeah. So that was the same thing. So I find myself watching that plaster pillow a lot and wondering how they did it. How did they, I mean, really, how did they do it? Did they make a mold of a pillow?
Yeah, because I mean, yeah, that's scary. A good question, yeah.
Or the they just poured it right on top and just let it.
No, that's yeah. not how they did it. They either made a mold of a pillow or they had a master sculptor come in and sculpt a pillow out of plaster. It's an amazing piece of.
You don't think they just poured it on top and just made
no,
it super stiff?
No. It's a solid piece of plaster. You can't just dip a pillow in plaster and then let it set up and then lean a 200-pound guy on it and think it's going to be. No, there's a lot of science going on in that shot. And trust yeah. me, that pillow is a solid piece of plaster.
Well, it's like trying to uncover. Yeah, it's tried like trying to uncover a stage illusion or something like that. You know, some
yeah.
And it's probably so simple, and that seems probably the simplest way to do it. But oh my God, talk about being yeah. uncomfortable. I would think they're
going to find out it was a rock.
It is a rock.
I got a feeling they poured a mold.
That was a bedrock.
Instead of having a sculptor come in because,
here's the problem with pouring a mold back then of a pillow. These days, we could do that because we have silicone molding compounds that you can put over very delicate surfaces and not combat the surface. Back then, you're making a mold out of plaster. You know, yeah. or something even harder. So I think that pillow is sculpted.
Could be.
Just masterfully sculpted by someone that was really good at replicating nature, which, yeah. you know, you watch those old sculptors that worked in plaster on the old Universal sets, like mm-hmm. all that stuff. That's the reason those sets lasted so long, you know. Yeah. If you go to Universal Studios now, you can walk through Visaria. There's a
picture
that's still there. And it's because they weren't making stuff out of styrofoam back then and coating it in resins.
That makes sense. Actually
plastering everything. So it was probably no big deal for some Italian maestro that was on the lot that was sculpting these giant, pillars for a Ben Hur or whatever to just run over and slap that pillow together. But it just boggles my mind to look at it.
Yeah.
So it's little things like that stand out for me.
I want to pay homage to an actress by the name of Faye Helm, who played Jenny in this, because she didn't really get a whole lot to do. She's invited on,
yeah, on this, it's too
this,
bad.
This date yeah. when Larry invites himself into Gwen's life, and they go to the carnival or whatever where the gypsies are having their thing. She gets her palm read by Boris by Bella, and he sees the pentagram, is like, no, get out of here, and then she's gone.
Yeah, because he knows it's poor Jenny, because Bella knows he's gonna kill her.
Yeah,
right. But the whole thing got set up. Evelyn Unker set this whole thing up as to put her in this third wheel position to keep the paws off of her from Larry. And it's like the whole thing is really like, if you look at, you know, the whole reason for Jenny and how it came about, it does not. It's not a good look for Evelyn's character.
No.
She got her friend killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what
she should have just gone on the date.
She should have.
Yeah, that's right. Should have just gone.
We wouldn't have much of a movie. It was
True.
Now the age old question. I don't think we covered this on the last time we talked about this. Is why Bella's werewolf was a four legged werewolf and why Lon Chaney Jr.'s was bipedal.
Well, I think this goes into, is he ever really the werewolf, or is
there you go,
imagination? Okay. Is he truly having some sort of psychotic break because he's not getting what he wants, or the stress of this new situation? The other characters, except for maybe Maleva, mm-hmm. we don't really know for certain if it's really him transforming into the werewolf.
No, we totally know that.
Why?
Well, first off, we totally know that Bela turns into a four-legged werewolf because we see him kill the werewolf with the cane.
Yes.
They've seen the dog, right?
Yes. His own dog.
We know.
Well, I was going to say, it's Lon's German Shepherd. Yeah.
His beloved German Shepherd who he used to take naps with in between. Right. We've seen the pictures.
Yep.
But like the whole thing with him, everybody sees the transformation at the end when he turns from the werewolf back into Larry. There's like a crowd of people that see it and they go, we're not going to.
Or are they convinced by his total insanity?
No, they see it. Here's what I think. Here's my answer to the age-old question. Why is Bela a four-legged
werewolf? Yeah, I'm just curious, yeah.
Why?
Because Bela's still Dracula?
No, because Bela's been at it longer.
Oh, okay.
The longer that you're a werewolf.
You become more of a wolf.
And you become more of a wolf.
Oh, I could go with that.
So when he says, the children of the night, what music they make.
Well, that's the other thing, too.
He's like, well, maybe it's just a continuation of his role.
Well, It could be.
Well, yeah, because it was established in some vampire movies that they turned into wolves as well as bats.
He's an advanced. Yeah.
Well, no, it's established in Bram Stoker's Dracula.
They can turn into wolves. Yeah, they can shift.
So Herschel Walker was wrong, you know. Yeah. Vampires are definitely more powerful than werewolves.
Oh, yes, I think so.
Yeah, well, I know so. That's something.
But you bring up a good point, Madeline, because the original script,
yes,
that Siadamak wrote it in that way. He wrote it so that you never really, you know, so that you wouldn't know whether it really was happening or if it was in his mind. But Universal said, "Oh no." Oh no, we're going to show up. We're going to show a werewolf. We're going to show it. So they had to rewrite it.
Even though they show it, it could still be all.
It still could hold up.
Except for the final scene when there's three of them looking down and they see it happen. And they're like, they look to Claude Rains and they're like, no one's ever going to know about this. We are all going to keep this.
Well, and that's why they say that she was attacked by a wolf and Larry died defending her from the wolf. Yeah.
Yeah. This was a big mistake. So that's where that kind of goes out of the window. It's like the old, and it's funny that this is brought up because it goes along with the whole, this movie has similarities to another one of my favorite movies, Curse of the Demon.
Oh, I love that film. I know
Demon Jacques Tourneur's great movie. Yes. And there's a lot of Jacques Tourneur in The Wolfman. And it must be because he was inspired by The Wolfman and the whole fantasy aspect of it. Because in his movies, like, the cat people stuff, you know, the Val Luton stuff.
Right.
That's actually Jacques Tourneur that was shooting all that stuff and making it so dreamlike and so fantastic. It all ties into that, you know. Is it all in our heads? Are these all like Jungian archetypes that we just have no control over and it's just the human condition is fouled up with all of this stuff? So it's an interesting idea for sure.
I guess we wouldn't know for sure unless the father got bit at the end while he was killing Larry. Then we would know.
He's rubbing his wrist in a very, in a very suspicious manner. You know, you don't know about Claude at the end of
this. This is what happens in small towns. Just one person. It just takes one person to make everybody lose it.
Oh, yeah.
Or be convinced of somebody's complete mania.
Like a mass hysteria type
scenario. Yeah.
Yes. And that's where I think that.
In a small you could still town. Make
oh, she's argument. Still on
I'm
this
still
thing.
I'm still on it. I'm letting it go.
Well, it's been a big, big discussion
for years. This is why I think it has excellent rewatch value because it's not definitive. It's not. Sorry.
It's definitive. They're seeing. I mean, you're absolutely right. That goes back to the wonderful subjectability of these movies, right? Like, we can all watch them and see different things, and that's why we watch them. I've probably seen this movie 100 times, and I see new stuff in there. All, like you're saying,
absolutely.
I never realized that that was the same church.
Yeah. I had to read it in one of my big film books before I realized that. And it was like, and then they showed the pictures side by side. It was like, oh, yeah.
Wow. That's pretty cool. Great.
So, yeah. Well, I mean, I know Universal used a lot of the same backlot. When we go into the next movie, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, they're going to be in a little city, the little town that looks surprisingly familiar. But then again, a lot of these.
I love it. It feels like, it feels theater-esque
the way
they continue to use these sets, and it's familiar in a fun way that we're still enjoying a story that we all were on board with.
Yeah, well, these
it's
were shot
in,
back in these days. Yeah. You know, these were shot like plays. A lot of them were. I mean, we're still only 14 years removed from sound first coming in. So, a lot of these films are sort of staged like a stage play, which I love.
Because they're also experimental.
Great. Absolutely. You
know, every single one of these is like experimental.
Yeah.
Because the rules of film hadn't been laid down so proficiently.
Right. Right.
You know, like the huge leap from Dracula to Frankenstein, which was only a year.
Right.
And it's just a huge expanse of learning happened, you know. So they're like, oh, we really don't have to film the stage anymore.
Right.
You know, now we can do this thing. And then you've got these German expressionist guys coming over, and you've got Carl Freund moving the camera through rooms and stuff. And they're like, oh, wow, now we have a subjective camera. This is changing the whole thing, you know. So you can actually see the experimentation happened and the growth of film happened through these movies, because I think they were trying more with these movies because they could get away with more. And the directors were like, okay, well, I'm making this crazy movie. I think I'm going to try this thing here. And the studio is not going to notice because it's this wacky movie that they're making. So there's so much grand experimentation going on in these films, you know, like, I mean, just the fact that they let James Whale make so many of them.
Oh my God! Yeah,
the stuff he was getting away with, those James Whale ones are really smarter than all of the other ones. Usually, you know, there's so much heavy subtext in those movies.
Oh, he was so far ahead of the game. Yeah,
yeah,
it was unbelievable.
Was. And this one though, for 41, because the other movies around 40, the horror cycle was over. You know.
Yep.
And for this thing to happen. It really rejuvenated the thing, so that it almost felt like, oh, we've got something to prove. We're going to make this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Cause there's a whole new generation that comes out of this with the House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula, and, the Frankenstein one carries on through Ghost. And,
this started the second horror cycle.
Yeah,
so they were like laying the groundwork. They're like, oh, we're gonna make this really good because we're gonna build on this thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it feels that way. It feels like this isn't like some, you know, throwaway horror movie thing. This is like they're really working to make it great, from everything from the, like, you know, the set design to you know, the not just the makeup, which was groundbreaking. It might be one of the first you know, foam appliances used. I mean, there's a lot of neat stuff in this movie.
Well, I think that's why the Universals have lasted so long and are so beloved, because horror and scary movies in the early days were sort of considered kiddie fare. And, you know, it wasn't really taken seriously by a lot of these big studios, but Universal really put something into these. There's a real heart behind them.
Yeah.
I mean, they are labors of love, not only among the crew, but the cast as well. I mean, you can tell that these are, you know, there's a lot to them. I mean, this movie runs 100, you know, an hour and 9 minutes, 69 minutes, and they pack more into that than most films would put in hour and a half.
I love that. Shane and I have remarked on this frequently, where we sit to watch a movie and a new movie.
Yeah.
30 minutes have gone by and nothing has happened.
Yes.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing has happened. And it's frustrating. I could tell a better story in 15 minutes.
Yeah. We have been lamenting this a lot.
Yeah.
This is a real bad problem now that movies have to be episodic. And now all the movies being made are like 12 hours to 16 hours long.
Right.
And it's terrible because we watch a lot. I mean, we must be out of touch because we watch a lot of silent films and stuff
like that.
Oh, I love
silent films.
And they get it done in an hour.
That's right. They go right to it.
And some of these things are rich, rich films. Like this, I'm surprised at The Wolfman. I thought we had like an hour and a half almost with this. I'm surprised.
You've got enough information in there that you would think it was.
Yeah.
Because you get so engrossed in it. I was really paying attention to that this morning again, because it's like, no, that can't be right. It's got to be longer than
that. Well, it's the economy of it. You know, there's nothing superfluous. Yeah. There's no characters.
There's no padding. It's all story. All story, all visuals. It's got a great mood, great ambiance, great music.
Yeah.
And all American films today are nothing but padding and spectacle.
No, yeah.
It's just padding to the next spectacle. It's just
you've got a director who has a couple of particular action sequences or something that they really are into, and then the rest is just, well, we'll figure some way to tie them together.
Yeah.
You know, and it feels that way. It really does. There's no storytelling to it.
Yeah, people have been lamenting this AI taking over, but I watch a lot. We see a lot of these modern films, and we're like, it's almost as if AI is already writing these things because there's so many
about making sales and tapping into X market or X age group, or
it's made by committee.
What kinds of things can we sell
The merchandising aspect of it just got out of control.
Story and characterization takes a back seat to all of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that got out of control.
How can
we
pay for the next thing? It's painful. You can see the formula as you're watching the film. I felt this way about, I mean, several recently, and I don't want to pick on any one franchise,
here's the watch commercial, here's the car commercial, here's the soda pop commercial,
here's the new robot you need to buy commercial.
Mm-hmm. it is spoofed so brilliantly in the movie Return of the Killer Tomatoes, because this is back in the 70s, but they made half of that movie. Well, I don't know if you've seen Return, but one of the hooks is that all of a sudden halfway through the movie it goes black. But you hear people talking, going, oh, God, we ran out of money. What are we going to do now? And the guy goes, I know, marketing, in-place marketing. And then also they come back and there's product placement for the whole next 30 minutes. And
that's
absolutely hysterical. But I mean, it was getting bad even back then. It was starting to get a little out of control.
but they weren't worried about that back in,
Yeah.
They're more worried about telling a good story and
those characters. That's right. And it's not everything. We're making kind of a generalization of current mainstream media.
You can see the propaganda in a lot of those 40s Sherlock Holmes movies where Sherlock Holmes is fighting the Nazis.
There's a bunch of that.
And
Sherlock Holmes is like, you know, talking about how great America is and all this stuff. It's like, okay, we get
the Batman serials are great because they were fighting Japanese subversives in the first one. And you know, and then a mad scientist, but who was, you know, using Nazi technology in the second one.
Yeah, they're always Nazis back then.
The one thing I do appreciate about these Universal films, and especially the Wolfman, and it was in Werewolf of London as well. He's a monster. I mean, he's as Maliva says at the end when she does her little prayer, the same one she did for Boris.
Bela.
Or Bela. Why do I keep keep calling him Boris? I don't. Bela is one of my favorite guys.
His character name in the.
Bela
is playing Bela. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I guess I just figured that's easy enough. Just use your name. It's a monster. Yes. I mean, yes, he didn't. It wasn't his fault, but he's still a monster. I was just sort of like David Naughton in American Werewolf in London.
Oh, yeah.
Nice guy, but, you know, you don't want to be around
him. When it happens, he's ripping people apart.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, when it comes to Lon Chaney, it doesn't matter if it's a full moon or not. Which, you know, I don't know if a lot of people pick up on that. The full moon thing didn't come in until, I think, the next one, if I'm not mistaken. I think that came in with Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, or it may have even been House of Frankenstein. But, I mean, you know, if you notice, they don't show a full moon in this movie. He just turns.
They show the light coming through the...
Yeah, but, I mean, it's like even in the little poem, which changes from movie to movie, it's not full, not when the moon is full and bright, but it's just... When the autumn
moon is bright,
or bright, or whatever, and she makes, I think it was Evelyn Anchors makes a reference to when she's telling Larry about the legends that, well, that happens, you know, particular times of the year, or whatever. She doesn't really say, you know. So, I guess that's one that they establish later on, the full moon aspect of it.
Yeah,
that's probably coming out of some of the witchcraft legends, probably.
Yeah, it might be tied into the Saturnalia and all that.
Right, that's what I was thinking, yeah.
You know, more witchcraft stuff.
But I love this, you know, we got into this trend of horror films with vampires and werewolves where they became these romantic creatures, you know, and I won't particularly mention any franchise, although people have heard me mention it before, that turns them into these Byron-esque type characters. And it's like, no, that's why I can't watch them. I can't watch those films because it's like, no, these guys are monsters, man.
Yeah, supposed to be killing people and tearing people apart and stuff.
That's right.
It's wholesome.
That's right.
It reminds us of what it means to be human.
Teenage love is monstrous, though.
It is.
It's rough stuff.
Yeah, maybe that goes back to what you were bringing up, Madeline. Maybe it is all in everybody's minds in those movies. They're not really converting. It's some sort of, you know, projected fantasy or something.
That's right.
Unbelievable. Let's see. We've been going a while on this. Any final thoughts on the Wolfman?
Overall, this movie is just always, I think, going to be a delight to watch again.
I agree.
It's no problem to be like, oh yeah, we could watch that again.
It has great rewatch value.
And it's we watch it, I think, multiple times a year, and we certainly watch it around Halloween.
Absolutely, yeah.
But this one, I'm certainly excited to show it to an audience of people.
I'm excited to see how these kids feel about it too, because a lot of these kids at the show, it's their first time seeing it. Yeah. Adults too, I'm always surprised. I ask the audience how many people are seeing this for the first time, and hands go up. You know, it's like, wow.
Well, there's a lot of people that will not watch black and white movies.
Yeah,
and you know,
it's so strange.
I talk to people about Monster Attack, just when I'm out in public or something like that, they go, well, you talk about those old classics. We don't watch black and white ones. Do you do any of the color movies? It's like, you don't know what you're missing. You have no idea. I mean, you want to see a horror film in black and white. It's not contemporary. Oh, there's a kitty. Something like In Cold Blood or something like that. Tell me that's not scary. And it's a black and white movie. Yeah, we got our
black and white stuff's the best. You can't really appreciate movies if you haven't watched the early stuff. I don't think.
I agree.
I don't think you could get the you can't really watch a Scorsese movie and understand it as well if you haven't seen these other movies that he had seen that really inspired him.
Parallel with certain works of literature that we all read and study in school, and then we have this appreciation for literature that we may enjoy later in life.
Yeah, well, these, you know, as I've said for years, I mean, these films, these are the ones that opened the door for me to want to be in the business, to act upon my acting desires, because I've been wanting to do that since I was a kid. But I mean, but these films opened me up to foreign films, to all genre films, especially film noir, which is still my all-time favorite genre. So, I mean, you know, while there were parents when I was growing up saying, oh, they're warping these kids' minds and they're going to turn out terribly and all that stuff. And I know some people may look at me and say, yeah, look what it does. But
yeah, look what it did to us. Yeah,
look what it did.
Yeah, our houses are filled with model kits and movies, posters. It's not so bad.
I tell you what, it opened up a lot of doors. It, you know, I don't know why they don't have, you know, in high school, I don't know why we couldn't read Frankenstein or read Dracula. They're brilliant pieces of work. Really, in my school, we did. Yeah, I had to do that on my own. You know, it's like,
oh, wow. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein was required.
Yeah, it should be.
There was some genre.
I think
stuff.
Dracula too, because Dracula is a brilliant novel. I mean, it's so many.
I didn't read Dracula until I played one of the wives and Lucy's mother in Dracula Rock Opera. I read it just to
for
the role.
Cool. Some rich literature.
Yeah,
for scary stuff.
It was really innovative at the time.
It was like the first. Oh, yes. It was like almost like a cyberpunk of its time.
Yeah, with each chapter being told from a different character. Sort
that's
of.
Right. Well, almost like reading a diary, a series of diaries almost. Yeah. Basically.
But telegrams were new.
Yep.
So it was like kind of like science fiction-y stuff going on too.
Yeah.
So
yeah, really incredible. So tell us once again, as we wrap up here, about the upcoming Spook Show.
Okay,
for folks who are not familiar with it, or for folks who aren't.
So on Saturday, April 1st, we are going to be showing at the Silver Scream Spook Show, The Wolfman. And the Silver Scream Spook Show is a show we've been doing for 16 years now at the Plaza Theater here in Atlanta, Georgia, where we do a live show that people compare to Pee-wee's Playhouse meets the Monsters. It's a live magic show. It's with a no budget sometimes, and that's the charm of it. But and we do this 30-minute live show with monsters getting loose in the audience and all kinds of fun, fantastic things. And then we show a classic movie.
Yeah.
And it has educational value, and it's the thing that we love to do the most.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
It gives a real sense of community for
we are doing important work at the Silver Scream Spook
Show.
We are.
That's right.
It is necessary.
Bringing people together to have a delightful shared experience in a movie theater, which I think all of us can relate to.
Yes.
Can you give away some of the other films that might be coming our way?
Revenge of the Creature. Revenge of the Creature, which I don't think we've done Revenge.
Oh, you're going to do Revenge?
I know, we'll have to cover
it. Oh, a John Agar Tudor de Force. Uh-huh. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then we're doing At the Earth's Core.
At the Earth's Core with Peter Cushing.
Excellent.
And
Bride of the Monster.
Bride of the Monster for
October. Oh my God. One of my favorite Ed Wood films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's
Ed Wood's best.
I'm just you took the words right out of my mouth. I absolutely think it was his best film.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. So we're excited to see that one.
And Tor Johnson does not, Bela Lugosi does not say kitchen. I'm sorry. He does not say kitchen. Sorry, Mr. Medved, but you were totally, he says kitten. He clearly says it, so you're full of crap.
Hey, as gentle as a kitten.
That's right.
They might have shot it in a kitchen.
Oh, they did. Yeah, it was like a kitchen looking like set, you know, but I mean, it's like, I guess the mad scientist has to eat, you know, so he has a refrigerator and a stove in there next to the octopus tank. And the octopus was not stolen from
It was stolen,
but it wasn't stolen. A lot of the rumor went around for years that it was the one used in 20,000 Leagues. And it's like, no.
It was stolen from RKO.
It was an RKO studios.
The one for the Disney movie wasn't for they were shooting that movie at the same time.
That's right.
You know,
and it was a squid. It wasn't an octopus.
Yeah. You
know. Can you imagine Bela Lugosi in that creek trying to pull a squid around him? That wouldn't work. It just wouldn't work.
He's not going to wrestle that Disney one. That thing was 100 feet long.
Oh, I know, man.
Yeah.
That'd be quite the theft.
Two totally different levels of special effects going on there.
Now, is Bride of the Monster going to be the first Ed Wood you've ever shown in the spook
show?
Oh,
no, we've shown some other all Ed Woods.
You have? Excellent, excellent.
Yeah.
See, folks?
Ed Wood is the patron saint of the Silver Scream spook show.
I have more admiration for Ed. I remember seeing when I saw Plan 9 for the very first time. Nobody knew what it was. It was on a midnight monster show. I was living in an apartment with three other guys. We were just finishing up college, and we're like, oh, Bela Lugosi, this ought to be pretty good. And then it was
and
like,
your minds were blown.
10 minutes later, it's like, what the hell is this?
Yeah. That I had a similar experience.
Yeah.
My brother Sergey and I had trick-or-treated all night, and we had come home jacked up on candy, and my father was like, all right, something special is happening tonight. You're going to see the weirdest movie you will ever see. And we were like, what? And he's like, yeah, this movie, Plan 9 from Outer Space, is really something. And we watched it, and we weren't laughing at it. We were, like, totally spellbound by it. We were just like, what is this weird thing? And so my introduction to Ed Wood was a little different, you know. And I always thought his movies were great and strange. He's, you know.
Oh, I still.
He's an artist that, like, I said this when I was in school for art, and we would show Ed Wood movies. I was like, one day they're going to teach Ed Wood in film school.
They will say he's
the DIY first maverick filmmaker that worked outside of the system and made these things.
Right.
And they do. It's a reality. They teach it in school. Like,
well, the author Bill Lustig said, he did something that a lot of the people that criticized him never did. He actually finished the film. He actually got it into a theater and got it shown. And there were a lot of people criticizing him in the 50s that never got even close to doing that. So I've always admired him for that.
Yeah, me too.
And as Criswell, the great Criswell, said, you know, he would be remembered for Plan 9 from Outer Space. And sure enough, that was the film that lived on for years.
And here we are. But Bride of the Monster is his masterpiece.
Bride of the Monster is just outstanding. It really is. Well, folks, this was awesome. Yeah, Shane, you got to sit in with us more often. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you for dragging him in here, kicking and screaming.
No, oh, yes. It was.
No, because normally, folks,
it would be added value.
Yeah, we usually record these very early in the morning, so this is now my schedule.
Yeah, Shane is not a morning person.
If you listen to the shows I record early in the morning,
she's the morning
up
person.
And at it 5:45,
so you're lucky to have her. She's a thunder lightning jumps at 6 a.m she's already doing it. Well, thanks, man, this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, I'm going to try to I say this all the time, but I am going to try to get to, I'm going to have to come to the afternoon showing of this because of my schedule, but so that actually may be sort of cool to see how the kids react.
Oh my gosh, it's so fun. It's my favorite part of the whole experience.
Yeah.
It really is. It's
awesome. And hopefully we'll cross paths again in upcoming conventions or so. You guys making any appearances anywhere other than the spook show?
We actually are focused so hard on getting this this studio that we're trying to build, home renovated, that we've really had to laser beam focus onto
on this project. So
we
there you go.
Start getting production shooting out of there so that we can start finally making some money off of it. Because now it's a money pit.
I hope you'll consider making my movie. Yeah, I've got a movie I've been trying to make for 16 years now.
We're absolutely considering.
We're going to have a studio.
We'll have a studio.
I won't even mention the fact I've got a part. I've got a part for Madeline in the movie. I don't want that to sway the decision in any way whatsoever.
Oh well, you know, just like
you know how nepotism works.
Yeah, you know how.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've been in this business way too long. But that's great. I can't wait to see the house when it's done. You know, the studio.
We can't wait to have you.
Great.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
All right. Yeah. Since we're now we're going to be neighbors.
Yeah.
That's great. All righty, folks. Hey, have a great week. And as always, we will see you next Monday.
Welcome to Earth Station Trek, a show that talks about Star Trek from the early days on NBC to the future on Paramount Plus and everywhere in between. We cover topics like
Star Trek versus reality.
Did the Borg get better or worse?
Finding the good in bad episodes.
Pop culture in Trek.
Star Trek pets.
Vulcan romance.
Religion in Trek.
Umox for fun and pleasure.
Kirk versus Picard and why Sisko is better.
Plus reviews of all the latest episodes. Check us out on your favorite podcast platform or the ESO Network.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.